Good morning. I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Thursday, the 23rd of August. Get ready for a highly animated conversation this hour as we have the author of The Party is Over, How Republicans Went Crazy, Democrats Became Useless, and the Middle Class Got Shafted. This hour of the program, Mike Lofgren is our guest. He retired in June of 2011 after 28 years as a staff member in the U.S. Congress. His decision to leave the Hill was laid out in an explosive article in which he said he was resigning in disgust after the debt ceiling crisis. He said both parties are rotten. How could they not be, given the complete infestation of the political system by corporate money on a scale that now requires a president candidate to raise upwards of $1 billion to be competitive in the general election. He has been a Republican, and so he's probably harshest on the Republican Party in this book, but he also talks about the Democrats and say that their problem is that they don't appear to believe in anything very strongly. The GOP has gone off the rails, the party he knows best, but it's a sorry situation. It's a symptom of a deeper dysfunction in American politics and society for which Democrats own a considerable share of the responsibility. So let's get rolling on this. Our phone number, I think we'll have more than one call this hour, is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@wpr.org. And our Facebook page, if you would like to leave a message, is The Kathleen Dunn Show. Hello, Mike. Thank you very much for being with us.
Good to be here.
You know, one of the I didn't think I would want to start with this, but the last hour of the show, we were talking with a biographer of a book on Gore Vidal, and we listened to some of the rhetoric, the intellectual rhetoric that took place on television some years ago. Part of what you write about is that the American people are pretty ill-informed. And if they weren't as ill-informed as they are, maybe we would have a different Republican Party and a different Democratic Party, and we would have people in Congress who were doing something for the American people if we knew what the heck was going on, if we cared about it.
Well, that's right. The sad fact is that although everyone wants to blame the politicians, blame corporations, blame political operatives and so forth, people basically have to turn off entertainment tonight, stop watching the reality TV shows or the televised singing contests, and maybe learn what the LIBOR is all about, the London Interbank Offer Rate. Mm-hmm. Now, that's very boring, but it affects the mortgage you will pay. That's the sort of thing they should be learning. And if they're not well-informed, they're not going to choose wise politicians. And another issue is, as a advanced democracy, we have one of the lowest voter participation rates in the world.
I know. It's just unbelievable. Well, you are a man who did a very, very substantial thing in your life. You worked as a congressional staffer with prominent Republicans doing budget issues for not a short period of time. 28 years is a long time. And you walked away from it and you wrote an article that received a lot of attention. And now you have written this book. You are deeply, deeply upset.
Well, that's right. When I began, the party of Reagan believed in compromise, cutting a deal at the end of the day, and governing. Ronald Reagan, when the deficit threatened to get out of control, he called for tax increases, I believe, three times, and signed the bills that increased taxes. He pleaded with Congress to give him a debt limit bill without any gimmicks or riders on it. He wanted a clean debt limit bill. He certainly didn't want to see the kind of circus that we saw last year with the debt ceiling crisis. You had people like, say, Bob Dole or Howard Baker, who had their own strong views, but at the end of the day, they knew that they had to govern a very important country, the greatest superpower in the world, and that involved compromise and getting bills rather than simply making issues. Now it has become different. And you can probably sum it up in two words. Todd Akin.
Oh, my. Todd Akin. Well, you got to expand on that. Sum it up and tell me more.
Well, I think the best way to say it is to go back all the way to de Tocqueville. He even noticed there's a certain anti-intellectual populist streak in the American public. And in most times, and in good times, that tends to be dormant. But these are not good times, and now we have politicians merely inciting this streak. So a whole issue, a series of issues involving science, climate, evolution, they don't believe in them. They do not believe in scientific explanations. And if you listen to Mr. Akin's tirade there, he doesn't have the most elementary knowledge of biology.
Right. It is astounding to me that somebody can be elected to a position where you just have the facts all mixed up. You're not speaking the truth about issues, be it about what happens when somebody is raped, be it about global warming issues, that people can just discount them. And you need to take some serious action to have these issues be addressed in some way. How can people get away with that, with just saying things that simply aren't true?
Well, we've reached a point in this country whereby there's so many alternative media which have simply become a kind of hermetic chamber that gives people affirmation of their own biases.
Mm-hmm.
So they walk around with a totally different perception of reality than what is.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not only science. We had a Republican candidate last year, Herman Cain, who was very concerned about the possibility of the Chinese getting nuclear weapons. Well, they've only had them since about 1964, and when they exploded it, it was a pretty well-known fact at the time. Or economics, Michelle Bachmann thinking a country going into sovereign default is no big deal. Well, I think Standard & Poor's told us last year that's kind of a big deal.
Let's
you
talk
can't
about-
have people like this running a complex superpower that is the biggest economic and military power on Earth.
You talk in the book about the Koch brothers putting a substantial amount of money into the Michelle Bachmann for president campaign. Why did that happen, in your view?
I'm not sure. You'd have to interview the Koch brothers.
I don't think that's possible. We'll try.
In lieu of that, I can speculate that she would simply follow rigidly whatever the sort of laissez-faire dogma that has now become the doctrine of the Republican Party, come what may.
You talk about a couple of events, and we remember the shock of 9/11 and how people were just in a quandary. They were dumbfounded. They were wandering the streets of Washington, D.C., looking for some kind of shelter, not knowing if they were going to die or not. That the twin shocks, you write, of 9/11 and then also the financial collapse in 2008 caused a significant segment of the American people to collectively lose their minds, you say. Is it understandable that we would have lost our minds because of those shocks and it just is taking a long time to adjust to them?
I don't know the answer to that. I do know that it didn't really make a lot of sense after 9/11 when you're dealing with Al-Qaeda in Afghanistan to pull resources out of there to invade the wrong country on a pretext that was false, that ended up costing us 5,000 American lives and $1 trillion when you add debt service. That was simply not an intelligent thing to do, but it was the result of a kind of mass hysteria where people were made very suggestible, and the media and the editorial boards all went along with it, with very few exceptions.
Nobody knew the history. Everybody was scrambling to figure out why this had happened and what the history was and how to pronounce the names of places and tribes. And it was amazing how little we knew.
Yes, very amazing how little we knew, given that beginning in 1979, Saddam Hussein was an ally of ours for about 10 years. Then we fought a war with him in 1991, and then we had very extensive series of sanctions. So one would hope that people kind of understood better than they did what was going on if they just paid attention. And that includes members of Congress, too. All those Democratic members who voted for war, I read the same stuff they did, and it was very thinly sourced and tendentious intelligence material, and it was not a reason to go to war.
Mm-hmm. What about the Democratic Party? You write about the fact that they just don't appear to believe in anything very strongly, and you cite their losing 3 presidential elections in a row as being perhaps the reason for that, that they want power just as much as the Republicans.
Yes, after that series of losses in the 1980s, they decided to retool, and I think the Democratic Leadership Council types became more predominant, and that signaled a sort of corporate-friendly party, and one that was not averse to going to war on flimsy pretexts, potentially. And we saw that this retooling certainly helped Bill Clinton get elected. But somehow by his second term, he was signing the repeal of Glass-Steagall. He was signing bills that would totally deregulate the derivatives trade. He had a Secretary of the Treasury, Robert Rubin, who, to say the least, was banker-friendly and who personally benefited from the deregulation measures that he lobbied for.
And so does fundamentally it all get back to how we elect people, and that there is no way around any of this unless we have a different kind of financing of campaigns, because they are now costing, as you cite, $1 billion to run for president. So how else are you going to get the money?
Right. Now, somebody who texts $20 to his favorite candidate, he simply wants to see him win, and that's not such a huge deal. What does concern me is when somebody like Sheldon Adelson, who's already spent about $36 million in this election cycle, and says that he's willing to spend up to $100 million. A canny businessman is not going to spend that amount of money unless he expects some tangible return for his investment. And that, at some point, becomes tantamount to buying the political process. Now, as I said before, I'm not so worked up about the small donations, but I guess the problem is that you got to get all private money out. Because if there's any left in, it will be like water that simply finds the crack in the basement.
What did you see? You were in Congress for 28 years, working with prominent Republicans. Tell me what you specifically saw in terms of the influence of that kind of money, lobbyist money.
Well, it's not too difficult to trace campaign relationships between members and contributors, and the fact that certain earmarks unrequested by, say, the Department of Defense end up in spending bills.
money has rotted both parties?
I would say so. I mean, you've got, on the one hand, the money that we saved from not publicly financing elections, we blew many times over on things like Halliburton, an important contributor that got a sole source contract in Iraq and ended up managing it very incompetently and wasting tremendous amounts of money. And to put it in a bipartisan way, we can look at Solyndra with the Democrats. They gave money, and they got a loan guarantee for over $500 million, and now the taxpayer is on the hook.
Mm-hmm. Let's welcome phone calls. We'll take them momentarily. Our guest this hour is Mike Lofgren. He's the author of The Party Is Over, How Republicans Went Crazy, Democrats Became Useless, and the Middle Class Got Shafted. Mike spent 28 years in Congress, the last 16 of those years as a senior analyst on the House and Senate budget committees. So he was front and center when it came to decisions being made on TARP, Hurricane Katrina disaster relief, debates on Pentagon spending, and the inner workings of various deficit reduction commissions. He is our guest this hour, and we're welcoming phone calls. The number, 800-486-8655. The email is talk@WPR.org. The Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show. And this is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We start our phone calls for Mike Lofgren with Jack in Waukesha. Hi, Jack.
Jack. Hi.
Yes, go ahead.
I agree that lobbying is the largest part of the problem. It's the lobbyists were writing laws during the Bush and Cheney administration. Both Democrats and Republicans alike are guilty in that sense, in that they will do whatever the cash wants them to do. That cash, the billion that you're talking about, that's going to be peanuts. What Alito did is give it unlimited amounts of cash to be used. I think it should be across the board. No corporate, no unions, no Sierra Club, no lobbying whatsoever. If they can't put the laws together on their own with what they're earning, $140,000 or whatever it is in the House, get somebody else.
What do you think, Mike? No lobbying at all?
That it's very difficult to get around the constitutional provision of petitioning for the redress of grievances. However, you can certainly end the money. If you want to go in and talk to your congressman just as a citizen, that is your right, your privilege, and conceivably your duty. But that congressman ought to have his door open to all comers or none, rather than simply having it as an auction. And I believe the gentleman is correct that we really don't have a good idea how much we're eventually going to spend on these campaigns, thanks to the Supreme Court decision, the Citizens United decision of 2010, since a lot of it is going to be anonymous money funneled through these phony 501c4 groups. I don't think Karl Rove is particularly interested in operating a social welfare organization, which is what these things are called under the IRS regulations.
You know, I have heard, I'm wondering if you've heard this as well, that the airwaves are so dominated, I mean so dominated, by political commercials. It's just unbelievable that there are some businesses who are complaining to television stations that they can't get their ads on.
That's right. I happen to live in a swing state, Virginia, and it's just nauseating how much we have in the way of political ads. And this is a real payday for the broadcasters, and all the more reason that we ought to have, by law, a limited campaign season, just like in most of the countries of the world, one from, say, Labor Day to Election Day, where all candidates on an equal basis get a short, limited, but sufficient amount of time, equal time, to make their case. This business of inundating with ads is just getting ridiculous. And what it also does is give a powerful lobby in Congress, the National Association of Broadcasters, all the more reason to oppose any campaign finance limits, because that's the mother's milk for their revenue.
Hmm. Thanks, Jack, for the call. Paul and Bruce. Hi, Paul.
Hi.
Hi.
I'm glad to voice my opinion. I'm 90 years old. I'm a World War II veteran, and I did not vote in the last election. I was absolutely disgusted with everything. I will not vote in this election as far as the president is concerned. I'm going to get an absentee ballot to vote in local elections, but it isn't any use the way things are going. Why don't we just count everybody's money and make the richest man be president if we're going to do it the way we're doing it?
Paul.
Or the richest man be congressman or senator or whatever the case may be. He's going to get his way anyway. So why should a person like me? My wife and I raised 10 children. They're all successful. We use the public education, but we also educated our children at home. And nowadays, the airwaves and the newspapers, everything is overrun by money. And Thomas Jefferson had a good idea, but he went wrong also. He wanted a bunch of small individual farmers or a bunch of small individual entrepreneurs. And then what did he do next? He went and I never did figure out where he borrowed the money. He went and borrowed money to make the United States three times as big as it should be. And Abraham Lincoln made a mistake also. He should have let the South go. The country is just too big.
Paul, let me ask if you don't mind. You obviously have voted in a lot of presidential elections. What was the last election that you were excited because you could vote in it? Was there one? The last?
I just had to vent my...
Okay. All right, thank you. Let me ask you that question, Mike. When do you think was the last election when we had civility, we didn't have as much money in the election, and we had clear choices?
I couldn't really say in terms of picking and choosing. I do notice if you watch on C-SPAN or hear on C-SPAN radio when they rerun it, the old Kennedy-Nixon debates of 1960, these guys sound like geniuses compared to what I heard from the Republican candidates in the debates in the past year. They were civil, and both candidates seemed very well informed on issues of the day and on foreign policy. So it would appear that we have been on a bad glide slope. And as for what the gentleman said, to some degree, that is a deliberate strategy as a result of how campaigns work. When they energize their base and work people up on divisive issues, they're not looking for independent voters. They're looking not for the center, but simply to bring out their own base. And that's tends to depress the turnout for everyone else who just looks at the whole spectacle and is depressed.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Paul, very much for your service and for your call. It hurts to hear somebody who's reached that age in life, who is a World War II veteran, who's opting out, doesn't it?
It is indeed depressing, but it's part of the whole complex of how our politics work or don't work these days.
Here's an email that's come in from Felix. It's a Facebook thing, actually. What we really need to do is demolish the two-party system, open it up to more voices and more options, and get past this lesser evil stuff so we can actually vote for what we really want for a change and have something much closer to democracy than what we have now. Instant runoff voting would be a great step in the right direction, but it's not all that needs to be done. What do you think, Mike?
I would agree wholeheartedly. This two-party duopoly, it may have served us well at one time. It prevents the sort of fractionated, splintered political systems that you saw in parliamentary Europe in the 1920s and 30s that collapsed because there was no way to put together a real governing coalition. Now, we've gone the opposite way. We've entrenched the two-party duopoly so much that the hurdle for any third party is almost insurmountable. Things like open primaries would certainly be of benefit because it would tend to mean that candidates would be trying to get the maximum number of votes from all sectors of the public rather than simply energizing their base. Closed primaries in combination with gerrymandered districts mean that if you win the primary, you've essentially won the election. And if both parties are like that, your choice is really narrowed down.
Are you going to vote in the next election?
I probably will. I never tell people who I vote for. In any case, I'm not endorsing candidates, no matter who I end up voting for.
Mm-hmm. Let's go next to Rick in Elkhart Lake. Hi, Rick.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I'm just wondering, Mike, what you thought of the Simpson-Bowles proposal for the budget, for cutting the budget deficit. It seemed it was a bipartisan commission or people that came up with this, and yet it got such short shrift. I wonder if that's a symptom of the dysfunctionality, or I'm just wondering what your opinion was of that proposal. Thank you very much.
Thank
sure.
you.
That's a good question. I'm not really here as a flack for Simpson-Bowles. There's lots of things in there that people of goodwill could disagree about, but I think most economists would say that it was a balanced proposal. Just as most economists say, some revenues have to be a part of any solution to solving our deficit problem. Yes, we need to cut spending, but we also need to get more revenues because revenues are very low right now, and tax rates are just about as low as at any time in post-war history. Now, the problem with Simpson-Bowles was a lot of reputed deficit hawks, and I think I can name one who comes from Janesville, Wisconsin, always talk about how horrible debt and deficit are, but when it came to voting on a package that was fairly balanced, and again, there are certain things I don't agree with in there, but would trim $4 trillion off the deficit over 10 years. And these people put their ideology over their alleged love of deficit reduction. So I think their claims to being deficit hawks are rather fraudulent. They always take a back seat to lowering the tax rates of their contributors.
What do you think? People do things for a reason. Why is it, do you think, that the central premise of your book, that the Republicans have become ideologues on a lot of issues, very, very conservative, and the Democrats have become so wishy-washy they hardly exist? What's in it for either party to be the way that you label them? What are they getting out of it?
They continue as a duopoly. It would be hard to imagine people in Congress saying, let's gridlock the place so that it will reduce the public's esteem for Congress. But it's happened.
It has happened.
Sounds counterintuitive. I want to take pride in the place I work in, but they seem to be spending all their time running down the institution and making it impossible to function, as well as attacking government employees as being worthless bureaucrats and so forth. And the really ironic thing is some of these crusaders have been on the public payroll all their adult life.
Right. Well, don't they look at their poll numbers? They look at their poll numbers when they're running for re-election or when they're running for office. But when you have a 9% approval rating, that's abysmal.
Yes, it is abysmal. But if they get a base of support and everyone else's turnout is depressed, they win.
So you actually think that's a strategy? That's a strategy for winning?
I think that's pretty well known to have been Karl Rove's strategy in 2004. Just energize your base with polarizing issues, and if you get 50% plus one, then you claim a mandate.
Thanks, Rick, for your call. Jay in Madison, hi.
Yes, hello. First of all, thank you to the guest. I think this is a great program, and I mostly agree with him. I was aghast at this gaggle of Republican candidates and this utter nonsense that they were spewing during the debates. It made me embarrassed to be an American. I just can't believe that this is the best we can do. My question is this: what can we do? I mean, how is it ever going to get better? Where do we go from here? Is there anything that we can do specifically to improve the situation that we find ourselves in?
I think some form of activism is necessary. It certainly is something I have been doing to shed light on the problem and make people aware of it. Eventually, when the situation gets bad enough and enough people are incensed, the system will respond. If you look back to the end of the Gilded Age, the corporations were completely in the saddle. They owned legislatures. Any move against them was a conspiracy and restraint of trade. They had the entire Supreme Court, the Senate, and everyone else on their side. But eventually we got antitrust laws, we got child labor laws, we got various reforms and provisions in the law, because people insistently demanded it. So it looks rather dim right now and dark, but there have been times in our history that were similar, and we turned the situation around.
Thanks, Jay, for the call. Let's go to Bill in Lancaster. Hi.
Hi. What we need to do is we need to triple the members of Congress. We need to triple the size of our House of Representatives, and I don't think even that would go far enough. The reason why I don't think Congress represents me is my congressman represents, what, 300,000, 400,000 people? Well, how can my voice could be heard in that amount of people? That would also help to keep them or take away the power of the special interests. If they have to deal with three times the number of people, they're going to have to spend three times the money to keep them down.
Mike.
You're more right than you know, because the number isn't 300,000 people. It's getting closer to 700,000.
Hmm.
We haven't increased the number of representatives in the House of Representatives since 1912, and in the meantime, the population of the country has tripled. I have heard from some political reformers that this would be a good idea that could solve some of the problems in the way you described. It's certainly something to put on the table.
You also, and when somebody asks what can be done here, you do say that a warning, this warning about our decline should not be a council of despair. The U.S. is in not as nearly as bleak a position as our present predicament suggests. So there's a little bit of hope, you're saying?
Yes, partly for the reasons I already said, that we've turned things around at other points in our history. And also, if you just look objectively at the situation, we're not like Greece. We're not some little rocky country in the Aegean that lives off tourism, that doesn't control its own territory. We have a vast continent-sized country with lots of resources, lots of educated people, human capital. We control our own currency. We have plenty of energy resources. This is not a situation we can't work ourselves out of. Things look worse because of political dysfunction.
Mm-hmm. But there are also some very serious consequences. You write about the fact that, and you say this, that America looks today more like a third world country than an advanced industrial state in international comparisons of longevity, infant mortality, income distribution, social mobility, labor protection, average number of vacation days, and many other metrics.
Well, that's right. Basically, because we've let the political system get hijacked by people who are exclusively interested in their own bottom line, and if that involves outsourcing to other countries, so be it. We can't be a really viable country without a vibrant industrial base. We can't outsource our way to prosperity.
Kesser in Germantown, hi.
Yes, I mean, the direction that, that the evangelist and the Tea Party and Republicans like Mr. Akins, that, I mean, the direction that they're taking us in, do you think maybe in about 5 or 10 years we would see the Taliban as more liberals and us as more conservatives? Because the way we are heading right now, okay, no abortion and everything that we are just talking about, do you think that maybe in 5, 10 years, these people are going to say that a woman is at home and a mass place is to go out and work? I mean, what direction are we heading? I mean, your guest just said that this country is full of educated people, but is that the silent vote? Because I don't see these educated people speaking out. You know, this Mr. Akers, you know, 10% of people in Missouri are evangelists who are absolutely being with this congressman, that, you know, the statements that he made. And another point that I wanted to bring up is your guest just mentioned about Iran, you know, I mean, Iraq, that it had a 10-year war and they were, Iraq was our ally. Well, you know, I mean, if you look at it, there's a cemetery, a graveyard in Iran, thanks to our support to Iraq, that cemetery is about 50 miles long. And these were the martyrs, 1 million young people, Iranians, died in that war against Iraq. Do you think that if somebody had done that to us, we would want to be friends with them, or we would do whatever they ask us to do?
Mike.
Well, there's two questions there I have to unpack. The first thing about the religious right, well, yes, it has pretty much taken over the Republican Party. It's become the dog that wags the tail.
And yet, what about all the people? What about all the people who called Aiken and said, you got to get out of this race? That came from all levels of the Republican Party, didn't it?
The interesting thing is, and it's my theory, that the sort of plutocrats who really run the party simply use these social issues as bait to get people to vote for them. Most people wouldn't willingly vote for a party that says, oh, I'm going to make sure the rich get even richer, and by the way, your pension's going to be cut. No, they need to be baited with all these social issues. Well, now the tail is wagging the dog. A lot of them are afraid, less because of what the implications are, the philosophical implications of what Aiken said, so much as they might lose the election, and they might not gain the Senate. So, of course, they're ordering him to get out. But I wouldn't be surprised if he manages to stay close to Senator McCaskill in the polls. Within a month or so, that money starts trickling back in. And as for the other question about Iran and Iraq, my view is this country simply doesn't have the collective smarts to meddle around in the Middle East and control things to our satisfaction. We will have our hands full and be using all of our brain synapses just to get our own country in order.
Mike Lofgren, our guest. The book is The Party is Over, How Republicans Went Crazy, Democrats Became Useless, and the Middle Class Got Shafted. Mike spent 28 years in Congress, the last 16 as a senior analyst on the House and Senate budget committees. He left after 28 years, and he's explaining why. I think you understand why after the last 15 minutes. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Here's the number, 800-486-8655, email talk at WPR.org. Ron in Grafton, hi.
Good morning. I've heard a lot of suggestions today, which most of them are very good, but I have one that I think is important, and that is we got to eliminate professional lobbyists. We should make it illegal for them to have any dealings with Congress unless it's public, nothing private. They have to print everything out so that people can see what they're suggesting.
Mike?
Anything to make the process more transparent, I would definitely think is worth considering. The whole K Street industry is an amazing operation, and it really doesn't give much value added to American industry or American competitiveness. It's just a group of people jostling to get a bigger cut of the pie in Washington in the form of tax breaks, direct subsidies, contracts, exclusive franchises, and so forth. Anything to curtail that would be welcome.
Thank you, Ron. Lisa in St. Germain. Hi.
Hi. I was wondering if we're the only country that spends the kind of money we spend on campaigning for elections. And along those lines, it's my opinion that that kind of money feeds into the stereotype that we as Americans are greedy and that money matters for everything, and I'll take your comments up here.
Thank you, Lisa.
Yeah, I haven't researched in detail electoral systems in other countries, but I'm not aware of one that, certainly not a Western democracy, where money is so infusing the system. Maybe it's different in Putin's Russia, but I think we probably take the cake. And it's destroying our political system. It's damaging civil life.
Do you see a change to Citizen United anytime down the road? Does that have to happen?
Something along those lines has to happen. Something has to be done to get the money out of politics. Now, I don't know what Justice Kennedy was thinking when he said money in politics does not give rise to the appearance of corruption. I don't know whether he's been on vacation on Mars for the past 30 years or what, but it doesn't seem to be a very astute comment.
Mm-hmm. I know you've been a Republican, I would imagine, most of your life. You do talk about the Democrats having coasted for far too long on FDR's legacy, becoming complacent and feeling entitled to positions in politics, culture, and the media. There are some in the progressive wing of the Democratic Party saying, indeed, Democrats need to return to the legacy of FDR. What do you say?
Suitably modernized, it might be something to run on. The problem is they simply used the old formula, got very complacent, and thought they were going to control the House and the Senate forever and ever. And it just didn't work, and they didn't know what hit them.
Mm.
They didn't know how to deal with a guy like Newt Gingrich, who was very smart at dismantling the institution.
And you write at some point that you think the Democrats are afraid of the Republicans.
There is some sense of that, in the same way that you would be afraid of a relative or friend who starts acting very belligerent and a little bit crazy.
Hmm. Chris in De Pere, hi.
Good morning. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Great show this morning. I just wanted to say that I think, you know, it's true that both sides, both political parties, are pretty messed up right now. It seems that no one wants to work together, and I don't see that changing anytime soon. But I really think that the Republicans right now are in very rough shape, and I think it's because of the Tea Party. I really think the Tea Party is destroying the Republican Party because they're basically putting so much pressure on every Republican to be extremely conservative because they're putting up all these Tea Party candidates. I mean, I couldn't run as a Republican and say I'm a moderate and even think about getting elected. I mean, you have to say you're pro-life. You have to, you know, you have to pull all the way to the right, it seems. And, I guess that's all I have to say. So
thank you, Chris.
Very much.
Thank you for saying what you want to say. Mike?
Well, last year's debt ceiling crisis was a pretty bad experience for the country. That was partly incited by the Tea Party, and we could be heading for a similar situation at the end of the year, the so-called fiscal cliff, when the tax provisions expire and automatic cuts are supposed to kick in. Now, the Congressional Budget Office, which is a nonpartisan analytical office, said that if we go off the fiscal cliff, unemployment will increase by a point over what it ordinarily would be. So it's a serious problem, and I'm not all that optimistic that it will be solved other than simply some short-term extension that kicks the can a little further down the road.
Thanks, Chris, for the call. We go to Mike in Milwaukee. Hi, Mike.
Hey, Kathleen.
Hi.
You know, this is a great guest because this guy is honest, somebody who can criticize their own clan and do that publicly is so infrequent on both sides. This is truly a guy I could sit down and have a beer with here. But what I wanted to comment about is you had mentioned, Kathleen, about the Citizens United. There's a Madison-based group called movetoamend.org. And they're working nationwide to amend the Constitution to basically it says corporations are not people and money is not speech, period. And I just wanted to know what he thought of that and if he had heard of it.
Mike?
Hadn't heard of it. Sounds like one approach that maybe ought to be taken because if the Supreme Court is going to stand in the way, then maybe you have to amend the Constitution.
And thank you so much for the call. We don't have time for another call. So that little island in the Aegean doesn't look attractive to you at times, Mike?
It does, but I guess the economic situation there isn't very good by any means.
You could eat octopus and sleep on the beach.
Possibly so.
Right. Thank you very much. What kind of reaction is the book getting? Are people mad at you?
It's been very positive so far.
Has it?
Yes.
Even from people you used to work with?
Are they... some people who have retired or otherwise left congressional staff, they probably left for similar reasons that I did, but they weren't, let's say, as vocal about
it. Yeah. Thank you, Mike. Thanks for the hour. Thanks for the book. Mike Lofgren, the book is The Party is Over, How Republicans Went Crazy, Democrats Became Useless, and the Middle Class Got Shafted. Next week, of course, the Republican convention will start. We'll have our All Things Political focus on that on Monday of next week. Rhonda Fanning and Brett Jaspers produce this show. Thank you.